Well, it is good to see you this morning, and glad that you are here today. Before Emily and Sarah sit down, if you did not get a handout, you didn't pick one up on your way in, maybe you're just with us this morning, would you lift your hand up? Those girls will be happy to make sure you have a handout. You'll want to make sure that you have one. It'll help you as we work our way through. If you are with us this morning and you've not been with us previously, we've been studying the last few months together the Old Testament in a survey kind of fashion. What we do is we take one book of the Bible, or maybe a couple of books, and we go through those in the hour that we have together, getting the overview of it, kind of a flyover kind of thing, and it helps us to get the importance of what that book is about and how it fits into what we have called redemptive history. What that means is how God is working to restore to himself a people. Because that was destroyed in the Garden of Eden. And what God has been doing since is bringing back to himself a people who can worship him and know him and fellowship with him in a real place together. And so what we've seen as we began in the book of Genesis, and we've been working our way through the books of history and then the books of poetry, and now in the prophets, that the Bible is one book. It is not two books, the New Testament and the Old Testament. It is not a collection of 66 individual books, which have some kind of loose binding, maybe centered around some ancient tradition about some small Middle Eastern people group. But instead, it is one book telling one story, how God is bringing to himself a people. And so we turn our attention this morning to the wonderful book, the book of Daniel. And if you have your Bible, you want to find that as I give some introductory comments. As we've been working our way through the book of 1 Peter, you might remember that in the very first verse of Peter, Peter tells us that we are strangers or pilgrims in the world in which we live. There's that old gospel song which goes, "This world is not my home. I'm just a passing through. My treasures are laid up somewhere beyond the blue. The angels beckon me from heaven's open door. I can't feel at home in this world anymore." Yeah, that's how that goes. Well, what does it mean to actually be in the world, but not of the world? You've heard that phrase, right? Be in the world, but not of the world. Well, how does that actually work? And what does it mean to be a pilgrim or a stranger in the world? Well, there are some questions that will help us think about whether or not we view our lives that way. Do I actually think that I'm a stranger in this world? Do I actually consider myself as just one who's passing through it? Some questions will help us. Like what? What's uppermost in my plans? My dreams? Are my plans and dreams centered on this? Another question that might help us with that. There are all kinds of opportunities available to humanity in the world in which we live. Do I view those as opportunities to express God's glory to people who do not know them, know him? Or do I view those opportunities as occasions to make my life more at ease, further my own passions, my own desires? What does it mean to be a stranger in the world and still to be in the world? Daniel's going to help us understand that thought. The book of Daniel, of course, is a fascinating book. It has some of the most well-known Bible stories in it. The first six chapters contain many of those accounts, some of which we will talk about this morning. And then the last six chapters, chapters 7 to 12, are some of the most ignored parts of God's Word. Least understood, not the ones to which people turn with any kind of regularity. What I want to do this morning, and my hope is, that when we finish the hour together, that you'll see the book as one whole part of what God is doing in his bringing people back to himself. Not a couple of individual narratives that just happen to be strung together, but what it really means, as the whole book tells us, how to be strangers in this world and still live in this world. Some context for you in the book of Daniel. You, of course, remember where we are in our study of Old Testament survey. We are in the time of the exile. The book of Daniel is the only book which spans the entire time of the exile. So you'll remember that Daniel, as a teenage boy, is taken away from his native Judah. He is part of that first wave of captives who leave Jerusalem and are taken to Babylon, where they will serve the kingdom and the empire in some particular way. Daniel, at the end of the book that bears his name, still is in exile in Babylon, now quite an old man. And he's there when the first wave of Jews return to Jerusalem, probably around the years 536, 537 BC. So Daniel really spends the entire exile, all of it, away from Jerusalem and in the city of Babylon. When Daniel first arrives in Babylon, the ruling party, the ruling government, is the Babylonian government. They, of course, are led by that famous man whose name is Nebuchadnezzar. We'll get to him shortly. But in time, the Babylonian Empire is conquered by a group called the Medes and the Persians. So when you consider the context, chapters 1 to 4 and chapters 7 and 8 occur during the reign of the Babylonians, King Nebuchadnezzar. Chapter 5 records the fall of the very last Babylonian king. His name, of course, Belshazzar. And the rise of the power of the Medes then occurs in chapter 5 as well. Chapter 6 and chapter 9 record the events that occur during the reign of the new empire. That is, the empire of the Medes and the Persians. And the people of God, they're kind of just these insignificant tribal group that just happened to be a part of this whole worldwide war thing going on that involves the Babylonians and the Medo-Persian Empire. And in the process of that, what we find is that God's people are the victims of some pretty intense persecution. And that context does help us understand the redemptive history that is taking place here. Because the question that's on the table when you read the book of Daniel is, who's in charge? Who actually does rule the earth? Is it the dominant power at the time? Whoever has the most muscle, the most might, the most technology, the most savvy political leaders, are they the ones who are the ruling party? This is really the question on the table. Is it the Babylonians? Is it the Medo-Persians? Or is it, as we've been seeing in our study of God's Word, is this one who is called Yahweh, is he really in control? Or is it the kings? Or maybe it is the gods of those kings. Maybe those gods really are stronger than Yahweh, and Yahweh isn't all he claims to be. Because if he was all he claimed to be, how would his people be captives of people who do not serve him? Who's really in charge here? The question that we want to know is, how is this all going to turn out? What's going to happen immediately? What's going to happen in the future? When it's all said and done, who finally will be on top? Who will be the victor? Who will that individual be? And equally important in all of this is, how will the people of God behave? What should they do? How should they run their lives when they live in a world that is not their own. They don't belong there. These are the kinds of questions that Daniel will help us answer. That's why you might remember back in the day, if you were saved as a, if you were a Christian when you were a teenager, you might remember your youth pastor. You might remember going to Christian camp and hearing some evangelist talk from the book of Daniel about how you should live your Christian life. Well, he was right to do that. Because the book of Daniel deals with how you as a Christian woman, how you as a Christian man should live your life when you're not really a part of the world in which you happen to live. And so you have for you on your handout sheet the theme, and here it is. The Most High, the God of Daniel, sovereignly rules and reigned supreme over all mankind. Therefore, his people are brave in the face of persecution. In that first sentence, does anybody notice something different about how God is identified in our theme statement? If you think about it, you go back through the handouts which you have from the class. When God is identified in these theme statements previously, usually he is identified by his name, Yahweh. But not here. Well, why not? The answer to that is because, with only one exception, a reference in chapter 9, Yahweh is referred to in the book of Daniel as the Most High. Well, why is that? Because what's being emphasized here is that God is not simply the God of the Jews, but he is the God of all the earth. Everyone is under his authority. You'll remember also, when we were studying the little book of Hosea, that God said about his people, "You are no longer my people." How wonderful it is that when you get to chapter 9, that the word Yahweh reappears. And Daniel prays about the end of the exile, when once again the people will be God's people and he will be to them their God. And there in that one little word, Yahweh, that occurs in chapter 9 is a hint about the message of the whole book. From some of the books in the Bible, we can basically open to chapter 1, start reading, and get an idea of what's happening. It makes sense to us. Other books of the Bible, we are helped if we understand the structure of the book. And that's true with the book of Daniel. When we see how it is that Daniel wrote his book, it helps us to understand what it is that Daniel is trying to convey to us in the book. Well, what should you know about this? Daniel makes some very intentional use of structure. He writes it in a very unique kind of way, unique to ancient literature. Well, what happens here in the book? Well, let's think about what you know from the book of Daniel. In chapter 1, verses 1 to 4, Daniel and the nation of Judah go into exile. And then, near the end of the book, in chapter 9, we see it's time for the exile to be finished. All right, let's move into the book a little more. In chapter 2, there is focus on a king by the name of Nebuchadnezzar. He has a vision. And that vision represents four kingdoms. And then you get to the end of the exile in chapter 9, and you see in chapters that you see there a little farther in, moving backwards into chapters 7 and 8, more visions of more kingdoms in chapter 7. So think about this. When you're reading the book of Daniel, the first half and the second half have something to do with each other. the second half captures again the ideas that are first given to us in the first half. And the structure that Daniel uses is called a chiasm. You have it on the back of your outline, and you can on the back of your handout, and you can see the outline form there. A chiasm does this. It pairs parallel passages. It puts them together in groups of two, sometimes three. And those parallel passages meet right in the middle to tell us the main point. And that is exactly what's going on here. So look on your handout. The outside, labeled A and B, are the two parallels that I just mentioned. The middle, then, is the main point. And that main point is labeled by the section D. There are two stories of two powerful kings who are humbled before God. Even though they thought they were untouchable, they were invincible, they were all that, God brings them down. And it occurs right in the middle of those two stories. So you have your Bible open to the book of Daniel. And we're looking at chapter 4, verses 34 and 35, right in the middle of those two stories. And at the end of the time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my understanding returned to me. And I blessed the Most High and praised and honored Him who lives forever, for His dominion is an everlasting dominion, and His kingdom is from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. He does according to His will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. No one can restrain His hand or say to Him, "What have you done?" Verses 34 and 35, that's the major point of the book. God, the real sovereign, has humbled even the great Nebuchadnezzar, the one who initially conquered the country of Judah. So just to give you a little clarity here, I want to point out that some of the parallels in the book of Daniel are not quite as clear as these two in chapters 4 and 5. Sometimes you might read a commentary on the book of Daniel and you might find a different chiasm than the one that we are using. I'm not going to concern our time together with the various interpretations of that, except to note this. One, the book that is before us is built around the amazing humbling of the kings of men. And two, to note this, the accounts in the first half, those stories that make up chapters 1 to 6, help us to understand the second half of the book, chapters 7 to 12. So, let's get into the book by starting right there in chapters 4 and 5 with the main point of the whole book of Daniel. In these two chapters, there are two powerful and prideful kings. These men are arrogant. They believe that they rule their very large and expansive territories by their own might. They got it because of who they are. They hold on to it by the power they sway. They rule it by the wisdom which they alone possess, and nobody is their equal. They believe themselves to be the sovereigns above all other sovereigns. So consider Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar, the king of the Babylonians. In the first part of chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. And that dream is a very large tree. And in that tree, all different kinds of birds find and build their nests in it. And then all of a sudden, without explanation, the tree is chopped down. Well, by this time, the young man Daniel has grown into adulthood. He's risen to some extent in the Babylonian government. And because of the wisdom that God has given to him, he is respected by his peers, and he has become very useful to the king. In addition to that, Daniel has already demonstrated that he is a useful interpreter of dreams as God gives to him the meaning of those points of revelation that God made in ancient times. So in chapter 4, 24 to 26, Daniel gives the king the interpretation of his dream. This is the interpretation, O king, and this is the decree of the Most High, which has come upon my lord the king. They shall drive you from men, your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and they shall make you eat grass like oxen. They shall wet you with the dew of heaven, and seven times shall pass over you till you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men. And he gives it to whomever he chooses. Now, we don't know if Nebuchadnezzar believed Daniel or not when Daniel gave him the interpretation of this particular dream. But here's what we do know. The prophecy that Daniel told King Nebuchadnezzar absolutely came true. And verse 34 then reveals to us that as Nebuchadnezzar is lauding himself, showing the dexterity of both arms by patting himself on the back, a voice comes from heaven to King Nebuchadnezzar, and he is struck down by some kind of insanity that God brings to him. And every measure of capacity that he has to rule the people is stripped bare of him. And Nebuchadnezzar does not recover from this insanity and from this inability to act even like a man until he confesses the verses which we read, which make up the main point of the book. Remember, it was there that Nebuchadnezzar says, he does as he pleases with the powers of heaven and with the peoples of the earth. And so the story ends with Nebuchadnezzar uttering these words in verse number 37. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all of whose works are truth and his ways justice, and those who walk in pride he is able to put down. And that last sentence leads us right into the sister chapter for chapter 4, chapter 5. In Daniel chapter 5, the Most High delivers essentially the same message to another king. By now, King Nebuchadnezzar is dead, and there is a new person who is running Babylon. His name is Belshazzar. The problem is, Belshazzar did not learn the lesson that King Nebuchadnezzar learned. The lessons of pride and humiliation. They were lost on him. Instead, what this king does, chapter 5 tells us, is he throws himself this huge party. And at that particular party, he uses as drinking goblets to demonstrate that he is superior to the God of the people who are in his country and over whom he is currently the king. He is superior to their God. So what he does is he orders that the goblets from the temple of Jerusalem be brought to his party, and they will be used not in their religious, ceremonially intended use, but they will be used in a immoral, sinful, self-promoting way, look, I use these things for my own pleasure. And what happens? Well, this is where you have the handwriting on the wall in chapter 5. Where that revelation from God is, O king, your days are numbered, and this very night your kingdom will be stripped from you. And you can imagine that party probably ended rather quickly at that point in time. Well, what does the writing mean? They call Daniel in, and Daniel gives the interpretation. In chapter 5, he rebukes the king rather aggressively. It appears that Daniel is no respecter of persons at all. He is not going to restrain the declaration of God simply because of what the king might do to him when he hears the interpretation. And the interpretation is given in 26 to 28 of chapter 5. This is the interpretation of each word. God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. You have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Your kingdom has been divided and is given to the Medes and to the Persians. And that very night, King Belshazzar is killed. And again, the point of all of this is that the Most High will allow no rivals. There are no usurpers to his throne. There is no one who acts in any way contrary to him who is not under his complete and entire authority. He alone rules the affairs of heaven, and he alone rules the affairs of earth. And what was true in the day of Daniel is true today as well, beloved. God hasn't changed. He is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And so when you see peoples and kingdoms of this world acting in a way that seems so immoral and unresponsive to God himself, governing as if there was no God at all to whom they should answer, you need not fear. Because you know that God does see and that God does rule from his throne. So that's the main point of the whole book. It's the midpoint of the chiasm, chapters 4 and 5. We're going to move apart here in just a minute. Any quick question I can answer on that? Moving on then. So let's work our way out from the middle. We're working our way out from the main point of the chiasm, the structure. We're working our way out. And let's go away from that to chapters 3 and 6. And what we're going to see here is this. Chapter 3 contains for us that very famous story, right? Where Daniel's three friends, their names are, right, Shadrach and Meshach and that last guy by the name of Abednego. Those are their Babylonian names. They're not their Jewish names. And you remember, those three guys are thrown into the fiery furnace. What happens? Nebuchadnezzar sets up this huge golden statue of himself. There is an image of his own person made somehow of gold. And the order is given that everyone everywhere in the whole of the kingdom is to bow down before King Nebuchadnezzar, the statue that is, and they are to worship it. Well, that's going to be a problem for these three Jewish kids. Because they are monotheists, just like you and I are. One God. Deuteronomy chapter 6, right? There is one God. They can't bow down to this statue, even if it means their lives. They are as members of the people, these three find themselves as in a covenant with God. And they will not break the covenant with God, which was made at Mount Sinai so many years ago. God hasn't broken the covenant with them, and they are not about to break the covenant with Him, no matter what the consequences. Well, Nebuchadnezzar, of course, is furious at that. You'll remember that he orders that the furnace be heated so many times more. And then he says at the end of verse 15 in chapter 3, okay, what God is there that is going to be able to rescue you from my hand? Can you imagine the arrogance of such a statement? Is there a God out there? Because there isn't. I know this because I am supreme. What God could possibly rescue you from me? Well, let's find out. Some amazing words occur in verse 16 of chapter 3. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. That's some serious backbone right there. That is some men of amazing conviction. They are young. They are not seasoned believers. They are not of gray hair and long tooth. These are young men who are convinced there is one God, and He is the only one whom we will serve. Well, that seals their fate, of course. The next part of the chapter, Nebuchadnezzar throws them into the fiery furnace. But you'll remember that God rescues them. They are completely protected while they're in the fiery furnace. And then we have one of these amazing statements, which probably serves us as a pre-existent manifestation of the person of Jesus Christ, called a Christophany. When the king looks in and he sees a fourth person in there, he raises the question, I thought we threw in three. Why do I see four? It looks like the fourth one is like the son of the gods. So the question that Nebuchadnezzar raises to these, what God is there who will be able to rescue you from my answer? From my hand, the answer is the God of the Jews is the one who will be able to rescue you from your hands, O king. And Nebuchadnezzar is just absolutely astonished, as verse 29 tells us. Chapter 3 has a sister chapter. The middle is 4 and 5, working our ways out. Chapter 3, the sister chapter to that chapter, is chapter 6. And here we have a very similar account. This time, the king is the man by the name of Darius. And the faithful servant is not Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, but the faithful servant is the man Daniel. And of course, this is the story of Daniel in the lion's den. By this time in Daniel's life, he is an old man, and he has a lot of enemies, and presumably a lot of friends too. And you know how the story goes, right? Daniel's enemies have been looking for every conceivable way to try to trip up Daniel. How can we embarrass him, humiliate him in front of the king, strip this Jew of the position which any one of us would absolutely kill to have? And so that becomes the idea. Let's find a way to kill Daniel. Well, what does he do? Well, he prays to his God regularly. We all know this, three times a day. He opens the window, bows his knees toward Jerusalem, and goes into communication with God via prayer. And so they advise King Darius, do this. Set a decree that for a period of time, no one within your kingdom can pray to any other deity except to you. Because, as you yourself know, O King, there is no one who is above or in any way supreme to you. And if someone does pray to any other deity besides yourself, let the punishment be that he is to be thrown in the lion's den. Well, once again, God rescues his servant, just like he did in chapter 3. And once again, God turns the mouth of a pagan king from one who praises self to one who praises God. Look at Darius's words in chapter 6, verses 26 and 27. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men must tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. Let's just pause there just for a moment. You and I both know that no laws can make a man or a woman tremble before God, right? But what is in play here is what Daniel or what Darius thinks about God and about himself. All men must tremble and fear before the God of Daniel, for he is the living God and steadfast forever. His kingdom is the one which shall not be destroyed. That's a very interesting phrase, because at present, the earthly kingdom is what? All right, let me give it to you again, because I'm not giving you this answer, okay? The phrase is, his kingdom is the one which shall not be destroyed. That's a very interesting phrase, because at present, that is, the time when he says that, the kingdom is what? Is destroyed. It doesn't exist, right? That's a hint about something much bigger than what is present. His kingdom is not destroyed, and his dominion shall endure to the end. He delivers and rescues, and he works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. All right. The point of all of this, of course, is to emphasize that just because the true God reigns, it doesn't mean that his people will be exempt from some kind of persecution. The fact of the matter is, they likely will be the target of much persecution. Think about it. Anyone who wants to amass power to himself, anyone who wants to declare his own greatness, he is going to find that the people of God who remain faithful to the Creator God are going to be, at minimum, a source of irritation to him. When he calls for absolute allegiance, they are going to be a trouble to him, because their absolute allegiance is to another. And when you think about it, that is a problem in 21st century America, isn't it? Absolute allegiance to Christ is frowned upon at minimum. Complete and total allegiance to Jesus. What is wrong with you people? Maybe you should be locked up. Maybe you should have some other teaching brought into your mind to change where you are so obviously out of whack with the rest of us. It does make people unhappy to have absolute allegiance to the Creator God. And the result of that is that God's people often are persecuted and afflicted, and yet they are willing to endure great trial and great suffering and great tribulation for the sake of the glory of the name of the God whom they love. Well, let me ask you something. Do you see how God is preparing his people for the age in which we live by showing us this in the book of Daniel. Think about it. In King Solomon's time, the people, did they think of themselves as strangers living in this world, just pilgrims passing through? I mean, they've got the temple. They've got God's presence right there with them. This is their home. It's not hard to live here at this time. And yet, in the book of Daniel, they are strangers. They are pilgrims living apart, away from the place where there was so much initial security and comfort. And even here, these people who belong to another kingdom, yet living in this kingdom, show all of us how to be in the world, but not of the world. Does that make sense to you? Any quick question before we move on to the next part of the chiasm? Yes, ma'am. Okay, I'll do my best. Okay, good question. So her question has to do with, you see these two kings, and it looks like the hand of God just comes down on them quickly and hard. And it's obvious, might be a way to put it, that they are being rebuked for their outward arrogance. Right? It doesn't seem like we see that today. And I think my answer to that is, if you look even in world history, recent world history, and even current times, look at the overthrow that is going on throughout the world in all kinds of nations where despots set themselves up as all of that. It may be that we here in the United States don't experience that because there is a huge measure of God's grace on us. That certainly is within the realm of possibility. Yet, it's not hard to see in our own government where our own government officials have been humbled immensely. How about Senator John Edwards? That guy was going to be president of the United States. Pardon me? Others. So, it could be, but I would also say that humbling is going on. Barack Obama is fighting for his political life right now. Every politician does who sets himself up. They all do. So, do we see it like? Do we see a man 7 years groveling, looking like an animal, eating the grass of the ground like a cow? Do we see that? We don't see it that way. That was unique to Nebuchadnezzar. God only wrote on a wall one time. But I do think that we see it as well in the affairs of men now, too. Yes, ma'am. Excellent point. Let's finish up here quickly. We need to do this in the last 7-8 minutes or so. The next pairing is chapter 2 and chapters 7 and 8. In chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. This time he sees a very large statue. And the meaning of the dream, Daniel interprets for him. You, of course, remember that the statue has a head of gold. It has a chest and arms that are of silver. The statue's belly and thighs are made of bronze. The feet are of iron and clay mix. That's verses 31 to 33. All of this whole statue, is destroyed by a rock that it seems is thrown down from heaven itself. And then when that rock reaches earth, it grows literally to become the mountain that covers the entire earth. Daniel goes on then to explain the meaning of the dream according to what it was that God had told him and had communicated to him. And he says that each section of the statute represents successive kingdoms. So Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom is the golden head, but the Babylonians will be succeeded by another kingdom represented in the silver. And that kingdom will be succeeded by another kingdom represented in the bronze. And that kingdom will be represented in another kingdom represented by the iron and clay mix. And that last kingdom is really strong, yet at the same time it's really fragile. And that's the idea of the iron and clay mix. Well, what about this rock that just smashes the statue and grows into this mountain? Verse 44 tells us that that rock is God's own kingdom. So, are you able to give the interpretation of that dream? What is the interpretation of that dream that King Nebuchadnezzar has? Quickly, someone? What's the interpretation of? You know this. Not a trick question. Kevin? Yeah, what kingdoms are there? Okay, so you have in the first kingdom, in the golden head, you have the kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonians. The silver, you have the Medes and Persians. The third kingdom, the bronze. Who's the leader of that one? Alexander the Great. This is Greece. The fourth one is the Roman Empire. The iron and the clay. Now, we have the benefit of hindsight. We can look back and we can see how each of these successive kingdoms was conquered. And we also see how that last kingdom is conquered as well. The Roman Empire in the first century was conquered by what kingdom? Christianity. Exactly right. Christianity is now what is in play. We jump ahead to chapter 7. Here's what we see. We see in chapter 7 another vision of four kingdoms. Well, what about these kingdoms? Here, Daniel, not a king, but Daniel has a dream of four beasts. The first of the four beasts resembles a lion with eagle's wings. The second one resembles a bear who devours everything in its path. The third one is a leopard with four wings and four heads. The fourth one is so terrible in Daniel's dream that there's absolutely nothing that can compare to it. Daniel only says that it has these massive iron teeth, it has many horns with eyes, and it has a mouth which is very pompous in its articulation of its words. And everything that it crosses, it absolutely and utterly destroys. Then look at verse 9 in chapter 7. Daniel says, "I watched till thrones were put in place and the Ancient of Days." So he's going to introduce us to this character. This is a vision of God. His garment was white as snow. His hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was a fiery flame. Its wheels a burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. 1,000 thousands ministered to him. 10,000s times 10,000s stood before him. The court was seated and the books were opened. When we get down here, what we find is that the peoples are destroyed. All the power and all the dominion that once was theirs now belongs to God. Verse 13, "I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. Then to him was given dominion and glory and kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom the one which shall not be destroyed." Okay, so who is that Son of Man? Who is it? It is Jesus. How do we know that? Write this reference down. Mark 14:61-62. When Jesus at his trial was asked, "Who are you?" What text did he quote? The text that we just read. I've got to move quickly here. You can study chapter 8 on your own. You'll find that there is a similar idea going on. All right, so we've made it to the beginning of the book. Chapter 1. Chapter 1 and chapter 9 are the last companion chapters that we want to look at this morning. These chapters focus especially on the exile. Chapter 1, on the beginning of the exile. Chapter 9, on the end of the exile. In chapter 1, all four of the Jewish boys, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, are placed in a kind of prep school for Babylonians. There they excel. They will someday serve the kingdom because of their training. You'll remember that while they are there in the prison, they bravely asked to have their own special diet so that they would not eat outside of the dietary laws which they were accustomed to. And what was the result? God's blessing was upon them. And that teaches us something. Even in exile, God's blessing is upon His people. It is not that God's blessing is all when they are out of exile, but even when they are in exile. We are called exiles. We saw that in 1 Peter in the opening verses. We too can assume that God's blessing is on us, even though we are not with Him eternally for the moment. And then we come to chapter 9. And verse 2 tells us that the exile is almost over. Let's look at this. In the first year of the reign, I, Daniel, understood by the books the number of years specified by the word of the Lord through Jeremiah the prophet that he would accomplish 70 years in desolations of Jerusalem. Question for you. How did Daniel know that the time of the exile was just about over? How did he know that? Pardon me? Mathematics. It's a better answer than mathematics. Pardon me? God told him. What did he read? He read the book of Jeremiah. What a novel idea. When we are confused, read the Bible. When you want to know what God's thought is, read His book. What a novel idea. Remember about Jeremiah? Nobody was listening to Jeremiah, right? Nobody wanted to hear what Jeremiah had to say. Well, apparently some guy was. Daniel was listening. We come to verses 25 to 27, and here the text says this. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth to the command to restore and build Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again and the wall, even in troublesome time. And after the 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the Prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end of it shall be with a flood, and the end of the war, desolations are determined. Then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. But in the middle of the week, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. And on the wing of abomination shall be one who makes desolate, even until the consummation which is determined is poured out on the desolate. Now, you can go back and read those verses again. Go back and get out your notes when we were studying the book of Matthew. And you can see what is here and how this prophecy about rebuilding Jerusalem is really a prophecy about the coming of Christ and His death on behalf of us who are sinners. Chapters 10, 11, and 12 then do not fit the chiasm that we've been talking about, but they do fit the future of God's people, both the immediate future and the last day's future. And the theme remains the same: God's sovereignty over mankind, God's protection, and God's vindication of His own people. So, it should be pretty obvious how Daniel speaks to us as exiles. We should be able to see that by now. Chapters 4 and 5 those who set themselves up against God, he will humble them. Some for their benefit, Nebuchadnezzar. I fully anticipate meeting Nebuchadnezzar in heaven someday. Some are humbled to their ruin. I do not expect meeting Belshazzar in heaven someday. Chapters 3 and 6, what it looks like to be faithful servants of a sovereign Lord, even when experiencing opposition for our faith. Chapters 2 and 7 and 8, how the great powers around us all are passing away. They come and they go, but God's kingdom on earth will last forever. And there is, chapters 10 to 12, an eternal reward awaiting us when we finally experience the return home away from the exile. So, we're done with the major prophets, and we'll pick up next time in the book of Chronicles. God bless you. Thank you.